All right, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. Now I'm going to talk now about the last of the sutra texts that we are going to cover in this course, and that's the Lankavatara Sutra. Before I talk specifically about the sutra, I want to put the sutra into some kind of context, not only the Lankavatara Sutra, but also the Perfection of Wisdom sutras that we have just finished talking about. In the Mahayana tradition, we have a classification or a conception of what we call the three turnings of the wheel of the Dharma. And we say that the Buddha turned the wheel of the Dharma three times. The first time was at the deer park near Varanasi, when he taught the Four Noble Truths and so forth in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta and so forth. That was the first turning of the wheel of the Dharma. And included in that turning of the wheel of the Dharma are all the texts that talk about aggregates, elements, sense spheres, and so forth, and also other subjects such as interdependent origination and not-self and so on. And then we have the second turning of the wheel of the Dharma, and the second turning of the wheel of the Dharma includes those texts that belong to the Perfection of Wisdom category, which talk about emptiness, whose principal subject matter is emptiness. And then we say there was a third turning of the wheel of the Dharma, where the Buddha talked about the importance of mind and the role of mind. And specifically, I mention this because I want to draw your attention to the relationship between the Perfection of Wisdom teaching, which is fundamentally emptiness, that all elements, all dharmas, all factors are empty, and the teaching of the this tradition. The name of this tradition, the mind only tradition, is difficult. It's difficult to find a good translation. I like to translate it mentalist, but then this is so sort of esoteric, many people wouldn't understand if I called it simply the mentalist tradition. But anyway, I wanted to indicate the relationship, the general relationship between the Perfection of Wisdom tradition that teaches the emptiness of all phenomena and the mind-only tradition that teaches the centrality, the primacy of the mind in the evolution, in the appearance of the phenomenal world. So these two phases in the declaration, in the exposition of Mahayana philosophy, these two phases are very closely interrelated. They're interrelated because what emptiness, what the Perfection of Wisdom teaches us is that all phenomena are empty. So that, in a sense, the Perfection of Wisdom teaching leaves us with an empty canvas or an empty stage where everything is empty, where nothing exists. In emptiness, there is no form, there is no feeling, etc. There is no eye, there is no ear, there is no sound, and so forth. We're left with an empty stage. Literally, the Perfection of Wisdom discourses teach emptiness, and we're left with emptiness. We're left with an empty canvas, an empty stage, an empty screen. And what does the mind-only tradition do for us? What does the mind-only tradition contribute? The mentalist tradition, the tradition that is represented here in this course by the Lankavatara Sutra. There are other sutras that belong to this phase. But here we're going to look at the Lankavatara Sutra. What does the Lankavatara Sutra teach us? The Lankavatara teaches us how this emptiness comes to be filled up. How this emptiness, how the world appears out of this emptiness. Since in reality all of this is empty, there really doesn't exist anything. Not the slightest thing exists in reality. And yet all of this world appears to us, living beings, objects, houses, countries, all of these things appear to us. How do they come out of emptiness? How do they appear out of emptiness? So in a sense, what the perfection of wisdom teaching does is it wipes the blackboard clean. Everything is empty. Nothing exists. The mind only, or the mentalist tradition represented here by the Lankavatara, it tells us how this emptiness appears, how it comes to appear, and how we can make it disappear again. So in that respect, this mentalist tradition, this mind-only tradition, has a great deal to contribute. And that's why a lot of the insights that are drawn from the mind-only tradition are very important in meditative practice. They're very important in the practice of the Bodhisattva, in the career of the Bodhisattva. We'll see in the course in the spring on the theory and practice of the Bodhisattva ideal what a large contribution the mind-only tradition, the mentalist tradition, makes to the Bodhisattva career and to the practice of the Bodhisattva. But in general, I just want you to appreciate the fact that whereas the perfection of wisdom teaching kind of clears the board, it empties the stage, the mind-only teaching shows us how this world evolves, how it happens that we don't see emptiness, but we see manifold things. We see a lot of objects. We see a lot of appearances. How does this happen? Why does this happen? That is the contribution of this mentalist tradition. And I apologize for using a relatively eccentric term, but I don't like to call it idealistic, because that idealism is a movement in Western philosophy. It's not really, doesn't really apply to this tradition. And I could call it the mind-only tradition, but that's also a bit limiting in its meaning. So I won't overuse this term mentalist, but I just thought I would mention it as a kind of catch-all for those teachings that emphasize the role of the mind, the central role of the mind in the formation of experience, in the generation of experience, in the production of appearance. So the text that we're going to consider in this context is called the Lankavatara text. It's a text that, if you look for a moment at the name, you can see the text that is believed to have been taught by the Buddha in Sri Lanka. And if you are interested in dates, scholars generally date this document, and I underline that word document because we have documents and we have teachings. And the date of the document is not always the date of the teaching. In fact, the date of the document is usually considerably later than the date of the teaching. But if we want to date the document, as a written composition, then scholars generally put it sometime in the 4th or even in the 5th century CE. So it's, as a document, it's quite late. Now, that doesn't mean that it didn't exist in the form of an oral tradition much earlier. But if you're interested in the dating of the document, in the dating of the physical text, then we generally date it in the 4th or 5th century CE. Now, the text is very important. The Lankavatara Sutra is an extremely important sutra, and it had a tremendous influence, especially in the countries of East Asia, especially in China and in Japan. The Lankavatara Sutra is said to have been the favorite sutra of Bodhidharma. You all know, I think, who Bodhidharma was? Yeah. Even our Theravadan friends? Know who Bodhidharma was? Okay. So, it was the favorite text of Bodhidharma, and it is the favorite text of the Bodhidharma, of course, took the dhyana tradition, the meditation tradition, to China, where it came to be known as Chan, and then later in Japan it came to be known as Zen. The Lankavatara was the favorite text of Bodhidharma. Bodhidharma, of course, is a tremendously influential figure, did not receive a very warm welcome in China, partly because, like a good Mahayanist, someone who was familiar with the perfection of wisdom and the Diamond Sutra and so forth, when he was taken to visit one of the emperors of China, who was a very devout Buddhist, and who had constructed many monasteries and so forth, and the emperor and given many gifts to the Sangha, and the emperor asked Bodhidharma, "How much merit have I accumulated by all my good works?" And what do you suppose Bodhidharma said to the emperor? "No merit." No merit. And you know, and the emperor, of course, had he been studying the Diamond Sutra, he would know that no merit is great merit, and because it's no merit, it is great merit. But he didn't. He didn't understand that, and so he was quite upset, and he chased away Bodhidharma, who went up into the mountains and stayed there for 6 years until finally a disciple came and found him there. And that was the beginning of the story, you know, that was the beginning of the Chan tradition in China. So the Lankavatara has been a very important text for Mahayana Buddhism, especially in East Asia. The text it's very large, it's a big text, it's not like the Heart Sutra at all, it's more like the Lotus Sutra, it's a very large text, voluminous text. It's also very complex. We will be going through an excerpt from the Lankavatara. You will see it's a rambling text. It doubles back on itself. It repeats itself. It uses some very contorted and very complicated constructions. It's not an easy text to follow. I will do my best to underline, to highlight the principal teachings of the text in the first lecture number 7 today and tomorrow morning, and then we will look at the excerpts from the text itself, and we will try to extract the meaning from those excerpts. Now, the Lankavatara is not the only text in this group. There are a number of texts. Another sutra that falls into this category of texts, a sutra that teaches the primacy of mind, the importance of mind, another one of the texts that is fundamental to this tradition, to this current in Mahayana thought, is the Dashabhumika Sutra, the Sutra of the 10 Stages, which we mentioned the other day as one of the major Mahayana sutras. That's a sutra that deals with the 10 stages of the Bodhisattva career leading up to Buddhahood. Now, the Lankavatara and these other texts like the Dashabhumika, these are the canonical, the sutra foundations of one of the major Mahayana schools. We will be talking next time when we meet again in January, the second half of this course. We will be talking initially about two major Mahayana schools, the Madhyamaka school that I mentioned this morning, which is a school founded by Nagarjuna and which is loosely based on the teaching of the Prajnaparamita, of the perfection of wisdom, and which expounds, defends, and instructs people in the teaching of emptiness. And the other major Mahayana school has various names, but its sutra basis, its sutra foundation, lies in sutras like the Lankavatara and the Dashabhumika, and some others, but for the time being, I think these two, if we remember these two, and particularly the Lankavatara, it will be sufficient. Now, the school to which I refer has got several names. Perhaps the best known of the names is the Yogacara. It also goes by the name of Vijnanavada, and it's sometimes also called the Chittamatra or the Chittamatrika. Now, these names all have different meanings. Yogacara refers to the union of meditation and action. In this case, yoga refers to meditation, chara refers to action. So it's known as the Yogacara school. Meditation was important to this tradition because meditation supplies some of the primary evidence for the idea that the mind creates objects, that the mind creates reality. Because even according to the meditation practices, when one meditates, according, for example, to the Visuddhimagga and the path of purification of Buddha Gosha, a classical Theravada text, we find that the kasina, the support, in the process of meditation, very soon becomes a mental support, not a physical support. So there is a projection or a creation of the object of meditation by the mind. So this is a very early and very fundamental illustration of the capacity of the mind to create or generate objects. And this, of course, is a central idea of the school. Now, the school also, as I said, it goes by the name of Vijnanavada, which means the doctrine of consciousness, vijnana being consciousness. And it's also called the Chittamatra or Chittamatrika, which means the mind-only school. And or the just mind, the just mind school. So these are the three names of the school that was generated, that was established on the basis of the teaching of the Lankavatara Sutra and similar texts. And the school was founded by Asanga, by the brothers Asanga and Vasubandhu. And you don't need to remember that at this stage. We will talk about it next time. When we come to the second part of this course, the part of the course that deals with the schools and with the Mahayana scholastic tradition and the Mahayana Shastra literature. Now, the teaching of the Lankavatara is, the central teaching of the Lankavatara is the primacy of consciousness. The fact that consciousness is the main mover, the main actor in the phenomenal world. The fact that everything is created by mind, everything is created by consciousness. Now, before we have a lot of questions about what is the difference between citta and vijnana and so forth, let me tell you that in a text of Vasubandhu, who was a very learned and very competent exponent of the mind-only tradition or the mentalist tradition, in one of his texts he lists vijnana, citta, and a number of other terms, manas and so forth, and he says these are all synonyms. So don't worry so much about whether I refer to vijnana, to consciousness, to mind, etc. You know, you need to remember one thing about Buddhism and the Buddhist tradition in general, that Buddhists were never substantialists about language. They used language very flexibly. They used language very liberally. And terms came in and out of fashion. So the same sort of phenomenon, same sort of function might be denoted by a different term in a different text. And it was simply a question of which term was fashionable at the time. So this is why we say that Wittgenstein, his view of language is Buddhistic, or that the Buddhist view of language is Wittgensteinian. Wittgenstein, of course, was a Western philosopher, is known for his linguistic theories, and he was the one who said, when you want to know, when you want to understand a word, don't ask for the meaning, ask for the use. So how we use a word is what is important, not the word itself. And I can give you some examples of that, just off the top of the my head to show you what I mean. But take a word, for example, like icon. Tell me what does icon mean? What is an icon? Yes, okay, very good. I can tell you are quite an old-fashioned person. Yeah, exactly, because nowadays, if I've asked people, I've asked a lot of classes this question, and normally people say, oh, it's one of those little things that you click on the computer screen. But that's not what it was. 50 years ago, or even 30 years ago, if you'd asked anybody what an icon was, it's a holy image. It's a religious image, no? That was the initial meaning of the term icon, which has been almost entirely forgotten now. Now it has a totally different meaning, because it has a different use, you know? So words change according to how they're used. They don't have a fixed meaning. Anyway, pardon this slight digression, but I just wanted to not to avoid any potential concerns about this relatively liberal use of terminology. So the teaching of the Lankavatara is basically that everything is a creation of mind. And this particular phrase doesn't occur to my knowledge in the Lankavatara, although it may have escaped my notice. As I said, it's a big text. But it does occur in the Dashabhumika. And the Dashabhumika says the three dhatu, the three spheres, that is to say the kama dhatu, the rupa dhatu, and the arupa dhatu, these are three spheres in Buddhist, another way of conceiving of the world in Buddhist cosmology or in Buddhist philosophy, the three spheres are just mind. The three spheres are just the creation of mind. So this is the fundamental teaching of the sutra, and this is the fundamental teaching of the tradition. Consciousness is responsible for everything. Everything is just the creation of mind itself. Names, forms, living beings, the world that we see around us, all of these things are simply the manifestations of mind. They're simply the creations of mind. And once again, we can recollect now the first verses of the Dhammapada, and we can think for a moment how we want to translate the term Dhamma or factor in the context of those verses, because as I told you earlier, sometimes people like to translate the first verses of Dhammapada, mind is a forerunner of all mental states, all mental states are mind-made. But we don't necessarily have to translate the term Dhamma as mental state, we can translate it as factor of existence. And if we translate it as factor of existence, then of course the first verse reads, mind is the forerunner of all the factors of existence. All the factors of existence are mind-made. And that is exactly the same meaning, the same, that carries exactly the same import, the same significance as the statements that we find in the Lankavatara and in the Dashabhumika, according to which mind is the creator of the whole world, of the Tridhatu, of the whole appearance of the world as we know it, with all its persons and its beings. So how exactly does this happen? How is it that mind is the creator? Mind is the creator through the function of discrimination. This appears clearly in the Lankavatara Sutra and in the other texts that belong to the mentalist tradition or to the Chittamatrika tradition, the mind-only tradition. It appears clearly, but it is suggested even in the Prajnaparamita literature. It's not anything that is, let us say, in itself it is not particularly new. It is new because of the radical manner, because of the unambiguous manner in which it is stated that mind is the creator of all things. Now, how does this happen? It happens through discrimination. Discrimination is one of many words and many varieties of mental function. Here in the text, discrimination is used as a translation for the Sanskrit term vikalpa, which is very commonly used to explain or to designate that mental function that produces objects, that creates objects. Here also we can understand something about the meaning of vikalpa by examining the word. Kalpa means a mental act, an act of mental understanding, of mental projection. Vikalpa means variety or discrimination, therefore the translation discrimination. But discrimination, although it's acceptable as a translation, it's not the only possible translation for this sort of mental activity. We can even call it imagination. We can call it conceptualization. And then alongside vikalpa, we have a whole lot of variables, related terminology, parikalpa. We have samaropita. All these terms that refer to mental acts of attribution, of division, of individuation, and so forth. Now, let me just express this in simpler and more practical terms so that you have an idea of what the text is in fact talking about. And of course I am borrowing to some extent from the tradition of Mahayana practice, in other words, Mahayana in practice, how practitioners of the Mahayana are instructed to understand this function. Essentially, when we talk about discrimination, when we talk about subject-object duality, and here discrimination refers primarily to the subject-object duality, what in fact do we refer to? What are we talking about? We're talking about that process which is based upon the conception of an I, that is based upon the conception of an ego or of a subject. Now, once we have the conception of a subject, we also have the conception of an object, right? This is how we all experience and perceive the world. We, all of us, unless we have any sotapannas here or any persons of high spiritual attainment, all of us perceive the world in terms of I and other, in terms of subject and object. There is Peter, and there is the table, there's my wife, there's all of you out there, there's the teacup. All of this is other. So we have the self and we have the other. We have the subject and the object. And basically this is the same for all of us. All of us see the world in terms of I and other. And of course, once you have that basic duality, then you have a whole lot of trouble. You have a whole lot of trouble. Why? Because you then begin to distinguish, you begin to discriminate. And you say, well, there's this I, and then there's this other. Now, some of these elements, some of these factors that fall into the category of other, some of them I like, and some of them I don't like. So, for example, I may like the tea. So the tea is an object, which is an object that is other, which is not I, which is not the subject, but it is something which is pleasant, which is pleasurable to me, which is pleasurable to the subject. Now, fortunately, we don't have any mosquitoes here. But if we had mosquitoes, that would be an other that was unpleasant, that I would not like. I would not like the mosquitoes. So as soon as you have self and other, then you have some others that you like. You want to hold on to the tea, you want to grasp the tea. And if there is a mosquito, you want to chase it away. You might even want to kill it. No? So this division between subject and object leads to attachment and aversion. So this is actually how we explain the mechanism of getting entangled in samsara and getting entangled in birth and death and cause and effect and so forth. Because what happens? We have the self, we have the other, some other things are attractive to us, pleasant and so forth, and so we want to acquire them. Other things are threaten us, are unpleasant and so forth, so we want to eliminate them, we want to get rid of them, right? We want to destroy them. So those things we want to destroy. And because of this, in fact, this is just another way of describing the fundamental triad of the afflictions, of the klesha. Because the I and other duality, Buddhism has always described ignorance, has always explained, even from the beginning, even in the most basic Abhidharma analysis, the I is ignorance. Ignorance is described, is defined in terms of belief in the I. But it's not only belief in the I. For the Mahayana, it's belief also in the object, because the object, if you have the subject, you're going to have the object also. You can't have a subject without an object. So ignorance is the subject-object duality. That is ignorance. And this subject-object duality leads, on the one hand, to greed, attachment, acquisitiveness, appropriation, all those things that I want for myself, I want to keep for myself. On the other hand, it leads to all these other sort of negative things, aversion, things that we don't like, things that we want to destroy, that we want to get rid of, things that we hate, etc. Now, this triad of ignorance, the subject-object duality leading to this mechanism of acquisitiveness or appropriation on the one hand of those things that we believe are favorable or conducive or pleasant to the self, and those other things that we believe threaten the self, these attitudes, this mental condition, and mind you, this triad of ignorance and and attachment and aversion, this is kind of like a triangle standing on its tip, no? So in a sense, like the tip is ignorance, and attachment is on this side, and aversion is on this side. So because it's standing on a point, it's always liable to tip over to aversion on the one side, or tip over to attachment on the other side. It doesn't stay stable, because as we come into contact with different objects, we like some and we don't like others. Now, what happens when we like something? We try to get it. We try to grab it. We try to hold on to it. When we don't like something, we try to destroy it. So this leads to karma. And karma, of course, leads to rebirth, and it leads to the cycle of birth and death, and it leads to samsara. So this discrimination, this duality, the subject-object duality, which is another way, slightly more sophisticated or slightly more elaborate way of talking about ignorance, this duality leads to attachment and aversion, and it leads to action, because we get involved in action to get those things that we want and to get rid of those things that we don't want, and then it leads to karma, and karma leads to rebirth and to the cycle of birth and death. So this is the whole, you can see the whole wheel of samsara gets rolling on the basis of this discrimination, this subject-object duality, and the aversion and attachment that entails, and the karma, the action that is precipitated by that. Now, if we can get rid, if we can get free of the subject-object duality, if we can get free of discrimination, vikalpa, conceptualization, construction, if we can get free of the subject-object duality, then attachment and aversion will disappear, and karma will not be produced, and then we can talk about achieving nirvana or achieving freedom. So when the text says that, you know, everything is produced by mind and the appearances of the world are the result of discrimination, what it is talking about is the discrimination between subject and object, the duality of subject and object, and the fact that this precipitates attachment and aversion and action, which then becomes, assumes a more solid form, in the form of where we happen to be reborn, in the shape of our bodies, in the shape of the world around us, all of which are the result of our previous actions, which occur because of attachment and aversion, which occur because of the subject-object duality, which occur because of this function of discrimination, this mental function of dividing things up into subject and object. So this is the message of the text. Now, this is what the text says about phenomenal evolution. How does the world evolve? How does samsara evolve? Now, the real nature of the mind, the mind is not necessarily affected by discrimination. The mind, in its own nature, in its intrinsic being, is not necessarily polluted by discrimination. It doesn't have to be polluted by discrimination. We can eliminate the subject-object duality from the mind. The mind in its own nature, the mind, so to speak, not polluted by discrimination, is a mind which transcends existence and non-existence. It's a mind that goes beyond identity and difference. It's a mind that is beyond the conceptions of permanence and impermanence. It's beyond self, beyond substance, beyond karma, beyond causation. So the real intrinsic nature of the mind, the pure nature of the mind, the real nature of the mind, is beyond all of these dualities of existence and non-existence, identity and difference, permanence and impermanence, and of course, subject and object, self, substance. Subject and object is can be described as self and substance, person and thing, and it is also beyond karma. And in that sense, the real nature of mind, which is beyond causality, karma, and all of these conditioned processes, this mind is disturbed, if you like, polluted, or its tranquility, its purity is sullied, dirtied by the activity of discrimination, by the mental function of discrimination, by the mental function of conceptualization, projection, mental fabrication, mental construction. Many, many terms for this. Prapancha, parikalpita, samaropita, vikalpa, as I said, many, many terms for this mental activity of breaking up, of dividing, of projecting, of constructing objects. Now, if that can be eliminated, then we are left with a purity of mind that is beyond these alternatives of existence, non-existence, and so forth. So the fundamental nature of mind is, as we saw, even according to the Pali text, the fundamental nature, the original nature of mind is pure, it's luminous, it's without any features. What happens is that the subject-object duality disturbs the calm, the clarity, the purity of the original nature of the mind and results in the proliferation of objects. It results in the proliferation of dualities. First and foremost, the subject-object duality. Secondly, the multiple objects of the world. And then the emotional inclination toward aversion on the one hand and attachment on the other. And then, of course, in turn, that generates karma and that creates the cycle of birth and death. So that is the initial, let's say, the fundamental teaching of the school, that everything is created by mind and that the nuts and bolts of the process of creation of the manifold world with its multiple objects and so forth, that this is the result of discrimination, which plays upon the original, transcendental, indescribable nature of the mind, pure nature of the mind beyond existence and non-existence. Discrimination comes into play. We discriminate between subject and object, between self and other, and this initial discrimination, this initial imagination of a subject-object duality, of a real division between ourselves and others, this creates the whole evolutionary process that leads to the cycle of birth and death or to samsara. Well, I think that this might be a good place at which to stop, because I'm going to talk next about the system of the eight consciousnesses, which is a particular doctrine of the Lankavatara and of the Yogacara Chittamatra Vijnanavada school, and that's quite a big topic. So I think I will leave that for tomorrow morning, and I will stop here at this point.
Past, present, and future.
that the three terms refer to past mind, present mind, and future mind? No, I'm not. I haven't seen that. What I've seen is Vasubandhu's statement, according to which they are synonyms. I don't know. I don't know about that. No, I haven't seen it. I'm not familiar with that classification. If you can show me the source, I might be able to comment further. But at this point, I'm not really able to say anything. I'm not familiar with that that definition. Yes. I thought someone had a question over here. All right, then if there are no questions, I won't keep you from your dinner. If there are questions, then please.
Oh,